Thank you, Matt. Incredible. I think this was a great tour d'horizon. You gave us, you know, not only a sense of your vast experience in government dealing with Turkey and its many neighborhoods through which you went so eloquently, but also a sense of Turkey's political identity and why and how that is important for the United States. What I really liked was, you know, the fact that when you look at Turkey from the north, from the east, or from the west, or from the south, you see different things, and you were able to show all of that to us. You looked at it from Europe, saying that this is our benchmark, perhaps if I didn't hear you wrong, correct me if I did, that this is the benchmark of the United States for Turkey and its political system, how it should behave as a liberal democracy with liberal European values, becoming the norm for the entire society, and perhaps setting the model for other countries in the neighborhood, starting with Azerbaijan and others. But you also helped us see Turkey from the north. Oftentimes, when we look at Turkey from the south, we look at it from the perspective of Iran and Iraq, very important. But from the north, it becomes such a key country in the energy debate and the U.S. policy and the European policy to diversify away from Russia's monopoly of gas and oil pipelines. And it was great that you spent so much time educating us on that issue and telling us why that northern neighborhood ought not be ignored while we look at Turkey's southern neighborhood. You've also, I think, taken us on a tour of Turkey's, you know, vision, of your personal vision, perhaps, of Turkey's future and how it looks. You know, as I said earlier, Turkey looks different depending on where you look at it. If you come from the east, it looks west. If you come from the west, it looks east. And I think you've told that it has all of that. It's a country with so many identities, because it is in so many neighborhoods, but that it is ultimately a country that is, as we wish to see it, you know, consolidating its liberal secular democracy. And I found it enlightening. It's an issue I've been grappling with before I go into my question. Whenever I think there would be some soul searching in town on Turkey's identity, a lot of people have looked at this country and said, well, it's so much better than Saudi Arabia, so it's good. Well, it is better than Saudi Arabia, absolutely. But should a country, even if predominantly Muslim, which is not secular and democratic and authoritarian place, be a benchmark for Turkey? Or should Turkey's benchmark be its political system rather than the religion of its people? So perhaps the idea of European democracy is acting as a political benchmark with Turkey. And I would agree with that. I think just like, you know, we would not compare the U.S. to undemocratic places, if Christian, such as Belarus, we should not be comparing Turkey to undemocratic places, if Muslim, such as Saudi. And I think reorienting our visions to the West and to the European Union and hoping that this process will move ahead was a great endorsement. My question, once again, draws me to Turkey's southern neighborhood after having gone around to the West and the North, is Iran. You touched on the Iranian issue and as well as the successful U.S. policy to promote cooperation with Turkey against the PKK's terror havens in northern Iraq, and how that forthcoming policy is now helping turn around the relationship as well as you know, change Turkish public attitudes towards the U.S. I've been observing at the same time how Iran's PKK policy, in a way, for the lack of a better word, perhaps mirrors America's PKK policy. Here's what I mean by that. For a long time, Iran, which hosted and supported PKK camps in its territory, changed that policy entirely at the beginning of the Iraq War, and started to combat the PKK in an effort to win Turkey's heart, seeing that U.S. action against the PKK was delayed. And that helped, and Turks' favorability attitudes towards Iran warmed up significantly over the last few years. And now that we're helping again, Turks are once again looking at the United States as a security partner and want to promote that relationship. It looks like the Iranians are taking cues from that policy, and that's what I meant when I say they're mirroring us, and they are trying to perhaps up the ante with U.S. policy. So some news about Iran's bombing of PKK camps inside Iraq, perhaps, or right across the border, Iranian-Iraqi border. Do you get the sense that perhaps people in Tehran are looking at U.S. policies on PKK, a crucial way to win Turkey's heart for America? Do you get the sense that they are trying to up the ante with us? And does that mean that the United States should perhaps upstage Iran and provide further in the combat against PKK's terror havens in northern Iraq? I hope that was not a hard question, but thank you. Yeah, please.
Okay. That's not a hard question at all, because I can just give you my opinion, I guess. Yeah, thank you, Sundar. I don't really know much of anything about Iranian politics, but I surmise that what's happening in Tehran is what's happened for a while, that there are many people in Tehran who want to have a decent relationship with Turkey and who genuinely share a common hatred of the PKK, and they want to take care of that problem. And so rather than a premeditated attempt to undermine us with Turkey, although that may be part of it, I sense that there's an ongoing effort by the Iranians to get as close to Turkey as they can to soften the isolation that they feel, but also a sense that the PKK is a genuine problem. In any case, I think we're on track with the assistance that we're providing Turkey to combat the PKK. That was your second question. And I sense an amazing degree of commonality now in my own discussions with Turkish military leaders, or when I visited the amazing fusion cell, or whatever, the information sharing center that we have in Ankara, where we've got U.S. and Turkish military officers and intelligence officers side by side looking at very real information and pictures in an operational way that is, I mean, it's just inspiring when you see it, how closely we're working together. So I think we're doing what we need to do. I'm not sure we would need to expand that cooperation. I mean, if the Turkish government needs that, look to my friend Tuncay at the embassy, let us know. But I think we're on track.
Thank you.
Yeah, that one's not one. So how about this one?
Thank you so much. I'm going to open the floor to questions now. Before I do so, I'm going to turn to my boss. He pays my salary. Rob Sattler, to pose the first question from the audience, and then we'll go around. I'll identify you in the order that I see you. Please use one of the mics in the room and wait until I identify you. Thank you.
Matt, let me echo Sonar, and thank you for that very important tour d'horizon. You described the three baskets of deep cooperation, working closely together in energy and security and democracy. It almost sounded like this was a relationship between two countries that the that had a different level of poll ratings among their public opinion. And so I wanted to bring you back to that to that original point, which is, if this is the depth and the breadth of relationship between America and Turkey, and I think this is a very accurate description of all the things our two governments are doing together, then what is the impediment today to a better people-to-people relationship? Why is it that the perception in Turkey is not even as good as places like, I don't know, Pakistan, Egypt, places where anti-Americanism is quite rife? What is the impediment today that we need to overcome on the people-to-people level between America and Turkey?
Thank you, Rob. That is truly a profound and baffling question that I think about every day. I guess part of the answer is that when a bunch of government officials are doing good things, it's not the most exciting thing to talk about. Much of what we're doing is not known, but a lot of it simply doesn't have great currency. It doesn't sell a lot of newspapers or magazines. It's not that exciting, I guess, to talk about working together with the Abkhaz diaspora to help foster reconciliation between Georgians and Abkhaz communities. And even more baffling is what we all experience when we go to Turkey. In fact, I defy us to identify any American, or more than a handful, who've ever gone there and said they felt a lot of anti-Americanism when they interacted with Turks. Yeah, it's amazing how it's not just the sort of the formalistic hospitality. I mean, it's real. And so something happens in translating the reality of our government cooperation and the reality of feelings between Turks and Americans when it comes to the public mood. And I honestly don't know the answer. I do know that we've worked very hard, almost mechanically, to rebuild official relations. But, you know, perhaps there could be more effort paid to touting how important our relations are by the Turkish government. I mean, I wonder if anybody is going to give a speech so similar to this in Turkey anytime soon that lays out all the good things that we're doing together. That'd be helpful. There's certain regional cultural overhangs. For example, there were still a lot of bad things happened in early 2000s with Metal Storm and Valley of the Wolves and that whole incident. I mean, on July 3rd, 2003 was just so tragically misrepresented in that film. And I think just recklessly so, it did terrible damage to our relations. And I guess those urban legends take hold, and it's hard to turn those around. It's not a very clear answer, but it's just an explanation. And I guess maybe I've just elaborated on the question you posed, because it is baffling.
Thanks a lot. I'm going to go Tilly and Dalalu on the left.
Thank you. This is Tilin Daldolo with the Washington Times. How about now? I'll try to speak loud.
Can you hear?
How about that? Or maybe you can repeat the question.
Sure.
I'll try to do
best
to speak a little bit loud.
Oh, there's one coming to you.
Great. Thank you. Okay, this is Tilin Daldolo with the Washington Times. Matt, you said that you didn't want to get into the details of March 1st, 2003, but I'll try to ask you to do a bit. Evidently, Turkish parliamentarians made a strategic decision, and that decision had played a strategic role on the Operation Iraqi Freedom. That said, moving forward, the U.S. continues to face challenges in the region, like a possible U.S. troop withdrawal from Iraq, have to deal with the Iranian nuclear dilemma, to list a few. Now, having those in mind, the past and the future, can you, take a moment or two to reflect on what that March 1st, 2003 decision had left on the U.S. side? Thank you.
Well, what I spent all this time describing was how we tried to rebuild relations from what I'm going to describe through structured dialogue, working groups, elbow grease, a real effort to identify those common interests and make cooperation happen. But why did we need to do that? I don't know that I necessarily share the premise of your question that there was a strategic decision taken. You may be right, Tulin. I will never know. I know what was happening, what I felt on that day. I'll never forget. I got the phone call Saturday morning saying that the vote had passed. I was overjoyed. And about 20 minutes later, got the second phone call from the White House Situation Room, and I couldn't believe it. And what it seemed like was a very unfortunate case of mismanagement by parliamentarians, whereby there were three too many parliamentarians on the floor who abstained, and by abstaining rather than voting, the quorum was not valid, and the vote was lost, which is why I thought we had a chance to get right back in the pool, start swimming again, and try to have another vote where everybody had a chance to manage the vote in an efficient way. So I don't know exactly if there was a strategic decision or not, but the results were clear. I mean, as I said in my remarks, whatever sense of strategic partnership there was shattered, and there was a lot of negative feeling in both places, in Turkey and in the United States, in our military and civilian bureaucracies. Things kind of spun more and more negatively as we got through the summer and the Soleimania incident, and we got to the Metal Storm incident in Valley of the Wolves, all that stuff. But I also would like you to know that there's another side that you don't hear about very often. And I honestly will never forget this either. I was sitting in the White House Situation Room, where a lot of you have been, just after this vote. I mean, right afterward. And our senior leaders said, well, this is disappointing, but Turkey is our ally. And we don't want anything to happen that will destabilize the Turkish economy. I know people may not believe this, but that was when we said, or our leader said, we need to still offer $1 billion to try to signal the markets that Turkey is not going to be alone and won't be allowed to drift. So I think we, at the most senior levels, there was a sobriety that was constant, that showed us or that maintained that our relations with Turkey are important. They were injured seriously, damaged seriously, but needed to be rebuilt. That never went away at the highest level, never. Some may think that we retaliated by not doing more against the PKK early on. That's not how I saw it at all. I saw that we had all sorts of complex goals at hand in Iraq, as we all know, security and otherwise. And I remember seeing on the task sheets coming from the Pentagon, what things were our priorities every day, and the list was immensely long. And going after the PKK was on there, but there were so many other things going on. One of the analogies I often thought of is, there are a lot of them, but an airplane, when the oxygen mask comes down, and they always tell you, put the mask on your face before helping a child in the seat next to you, or a person in the seat next to you. And you know, we needed to breathe that oxygen before we could then get to this additional problem, which we had to get to. We didn't want to let our friend here suffocate. But my goodness, we had a whole series of other things we had to work on. And we worked through quite successfully, I think, some of those problems in Iraq, as we've seen with the surge. And now we're able to pull ourselves out of that negative beginning and do more against PKK. So there wasn't retaliation, but there was disappointment. But at the highest level, I think we maintained a stable course.
Thanks, Matt. I think one of these days you should write a book on 2003, and I'll look forward to reading it. I have Congressman Sollers next. You can use the mic on the table. They're supposed to be working now.
Thank you, and thank you, Matt, for your thank you for your comprehensive presentation. I have two related questions. The first is, do you believe that the ruling party in Turkey has a hidden agenda to impose Sharia on the Turkish Republic? And secondly, if the Constitutional Court concludes that it does have such an agenda and therefore bans it, and presumably the leaders of the party as well, it would appear under those circumstances that the process of EU accession by Turkey will come to a halt for an indefinite period of time. What consequences, if any, do you believe such a ruling by the Constitutional Court would have for the future of Turkish-American relations?
I don't know what hidden agenda any human being has. It's unknowable. We in this administration have to judge the government of Turkey by its actions, and by the reforms to date, and by the level of cooperation we're currently enjoying on all these issues I so painstakingly laid out just a little while ago. And there's a balance here between the constitutional principles that I talked about, between democracy, secularism, and the rule of law. But I don't. It's hard to judge what's in one's heart of hearts. I mean, we all have our personal opinions, but as a U.S. official, I don't have an opinion. when it comes to consequences for U.S.-Turkish relations, well, I mean, were that scenario to play out with regard to EU accession, that would harm U.S. national interests, because we really do believe, as I said before, our quest is a constantly modernizing, reforming, both economically and politically and in human rights, Turkey. And we do believe that with that accession goal not on the horizon, that again, it will be more difficult for Turkish leaders to take those tough decisions. When it comes to our own relationship, though, apart from the EU, it would be quite unfortunate if the way a political debate is resolved is through banning a party. Obviously, that's not according to the standard of the European Union. Clearly, and Turkey's not in the European Union. It's trying to get there. So Turkey's democratic system, its constitutional order is evolving, must evolve if Turkey is going to continue its path toward EU accession. It's up to Turkey to work that out. It's not appropriate for the United States to set any ultimata or threats. In fact, I just think back to President Bush's second inaugural address, where he talks about democracy by definition needing to be different in every country depending on cultural and historical circumstances. So things will happen in Turkey that may not accord with the way we structure our democracy, but at the end of the day, honestly, we really are confident that this Turkish democratic system is strong enough to work this out. Sorry if that's too much of a dodge, Congressman, but that's honestly what I feel, actually.
Thanks, Matt. I have the gentleman on the center table on the left. I can't see your name tag, so I'll identify you as the gentleman with the Chintamani tie.
Barry Schweid of Associated Press. You seem very upbeat, but then again, you're generally upbeat, as far as I can figure out. By the way, you called Azerbaijan an emerging democracy. I think you'd want to look at Freedom House as well.
Yeah, past tense and then hopeful in the future tense. Yeah.
They say that the energy money is working the wrong way in Azerbaijan. And in Russia, you know that. You know the report. that it doesn't encourage democracy, it encourages authoritarianism, and Kazakhstan, of course. But I don't want to talk about, I don't want to ask about that. I want to ask about why are you so upbeat on Cyprus, which is a eluded solution for since 1973 when Turkish troops moved in. Did you mention two states? Did I hear you right? Could you please sketch out, is an agreement, do you think, over the horizon? And what do you think its elements would be? What would happen to the Turkish troops? Or is this exaggerating just the beginning of a move?
The latter.
Okay.
What I was upbeat about is a process. There is a process underway, and process is boring, but there has been no process since the spring of 2004, since the vote by the Greek Cypriot community against the Annan Plan. So we're getting back to restarting that UN process. And that process last time around, under the United Nations, got pretty close to a solution.
Right.
When I mentioned two states, now let me be clear, the United States policy has nothing to do with two states. Our policy is that we support the reunification of the island into a bizonal, bicommunal federation. What I said was that Christofias recently said, as did Talat, in an announcement on May 23rd, that they support a solution that includes two constituent states within a united single state of Cyprus. And so I hope that's what a solution would look like. It's impossible to predict whether or not the parties are going to make it over the end line. There has been halting progress in the working groups and technical committees that are defining the agenda for the comprehensive settlement talks. But there are reasons to be quite positive about what's happened so far. It's not predictive, it's merely an observation. To have the two leaders meet, number one, is a big deal. To have them both say we need to restart comprehensive settlement talks under the UN is also quite significant. To reopen this crossing of the Green Line at Lydra Street in central Nicosia, Old Town, is significant. And so we're spending a lot of time now hoping that two parties, seeing how we can help the two parties get over the hump, restart the comprehensive talks in the next couple of weeks, and then decide what the appropriate form of assistance is, be it strictly UN or bilateral.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot. I have Oya Bain here in the front.
Quick question. There was an article on the Wall Street Journal about the Nabucco versus the South Stream, and your name was mentioned frequently, every
right there,
other line. Can you expand on that? What's the competition between the two lines now?
Sure. I guess you're talking about Nabucco versus the Russian-backed
South Stream pipeline.
Yeah.
Well,
you know, I described two particular pipelines that the United States has supported, the Nabucco pipeline and the Turkey-Greece-Italy pipeline. We support it because the countries through which those pipelines run themselves told us these are our priorities. So Greece and Italy on the one hand, and Turkey, as well as Bulgaria, Romania, Hungary, and Austria. So, like in the first round of Caspian development, we came in late and said, yep, we think these are powerful visions. They make sense. We want to support these projects. And as we were making progress, I think people took notice in Moscow and said we need to slow things down. And so you suddenly saw the South Stream pipeline proposed, which coincidentally follows the exact same route as the Nabucco pipeline and the Turkey-Greece-Italy pipeline. It has two pieces to it. I think what's going on is that Gazprom knows it is, well, the largest energy company in the world, either the first or second largest company at any given moment in terms of market capitalization, has a lot of wherewithal, ability, leverage to stifle competition. And it is by law, a monopoly. And that's what monopolies do. They stifle competition. So that's what it's trying to do. And one of the best ways is to undercut the apparent commitment of those European countries to the two pipelines we've been supporting. What that does, it gets back to Azerbaijan. I mentioned way back when in my talk that there's enough gas in Azerbaijan in the ground to realize these projects, but the challenge is to get the gas out of the ground at the right time to meet the demands of the investors. If you're President Ilham Aliyev, you don't have any hurry in developing your natural gas necessarily, right? You have enormous oil revenues. It's given your country the highest economic growth rate in the world, not just in the Caucasus, but in the world for 3 years. You want to save some of that gas for the future after the oil runs out. That's good for future growth. It's good for balanced growth. It also helps you manage the oil revenue stream that is so big right now coming in from oil, and as Bear Schweid suggested, creates serious dislocation in the economy and often makes tough political decisions even tougher on reform. So there's a premium, I think, in President Aliyev's mind, and Besser Aliyev can comment on his own. It was one to go slow. But what President Aliyev seems to have decided is there is a strategic opportunity to solidify Azerbaijan's connection with the Euro-Atlantic community by virtue of selling this large tranche of gas westward to these two pipelines, TGI and Nabucco, rather than holding it in the ground or letting Russia buy it or sending it to Iran. And he's right. There is a strategic payoff, and there was when all of those European countries were saying, you are our top priority, we need to get this project with you working first. And now they're no longer saying that. Now those countries are saying, well, maybe we're going to work with Gazprom in Russia. Okay, we'll do Nabucco as well and the Turkey-Greece-Italy pipeline, but really we want to do South Stream right now. And I would think if you're President Aliyev, then you say, well, where's the strategic benefit? Now I'm just as good as yet another Gazprom pipeline. There's nothing strategically special. And therefore, maybe I don't need to move as fast as I was planning to. So that's a long-winded way of calling on all of our allies in Europe to make clear that they're committed to working with Azerbaijan, that Azerbaijan's special in this regard, even as we hold Azerbaijan to the same criteria that Barry Schweid talked about in terms of democratic and market economic reform.
We have time for one more question.
Absolutely.
I have Savas all in the back.
Savas Suzal from the Haber Gazete. Hi, Matt.
Hi, Savas.
Yesterday, Washington Post published a story about State Department planning to open some diplomatic mission in the Tehran. And the AP also, they followed this same story. If this story is true, how do you conduct your dialogue with the Iranian officials? Direct talk or indirect talk?
Savas, I don't know. I'm not involved in that. So I wish I could give you a scoop, but I don't know. I learned about that from the newspaper as well. So I'm not sure. It's not my call. Please forgive me for not being able to answer that. But I do see I need correction. I talked about President Sarkisian's invitation. It's of Erdogan. Yeah, it's not of President Gül. I apologize if I misled you. Sorry, Savas. I can't. Savas Hayir, as they once said on the front page of the New York Times. Yeah.
Thank you.
We could do another one. Yeah, that doesn't count. Yeah,
one last one, quick one, Hassan. Mesut Hazar in the back.
Oh, it's for Gül? Oh, it's the invitation for Gül. Oh, okay. Oh, for Gül. Oh, okay. It is for Gül. The invitation by Sarkisian. Sorry, it's not what I heard this morning.
Okay. Hassan Hazar.
I think it's Erdogan.
Hassan Hazar, Turkey Daily. Hi, Matt. What does the United States do to improve relations between Turkey and the Iraqi Kurds?
Wow. I've never been asked that one before. What does the United States do to improve relations between Turkey and Iraqi Kurds? We usually think of it the other way. You know, what is Turkey doing to improve its own relations with Iraqi Kurds? What we can do, though, is dispel the Turkish concerns and misperceptions that we support anything other than Iraq's territorial integrity. So we spend a lot of time talking about how totally, firmly we support Iraq's territorial integrity. I think that helps then stimulate a more forthcoming approach by Turkey with regard to Iraqi Kurds. Because ultimately, really, we hope to see more outreach by Turkey's political leaders to the Iraqi Kurds. It's been difficult. There have been some contacts between Turkey's leaders and at least Netchirvan Barzani. We hope there'll be contacts with Masoud Barzani. We hope Prime Minister Erdogan will soon be in Baghdad in the next couple of weeks. But we really think that it's really up to Turkey to be reaching out to the Iraqi Kurds because they're Turkey's own neighbor. So we can help that process by, again, dispelling misperceptions that our policy is anything other than territorial integrity of Iraq. We are encouraging the regional government in the north, the Kurdish regional government, to do more to combat the PKK, to restrict the flow of equipment and money and all support to the PKK. And I think as that continues, then it's a lot easier for the Turkish government and Turkey in general to get closer to Iraq's Kurdish population. And finally, the third area where we're working together is what I mentioned on energy through our working group, where we see that the Turkish government has taken its own decision to deepen its contact with the government in Baghdad as well as the regional government, the Kurdish regional government, through joint energy projects. And we are playing an active role in that as well.
Matt has a flight to catch, and I promised him he'd be out here on time to catch his flight, so we'll have to wrap up here. But before I do that, I wanted to thank the staff of the Institute, including our caterers today, Rebecca Saxton, our research assistants, for turning our library into a place of wisdom and beauty for today. But more importantly, I also wanted to thank Matt Breiza for honoring us by delivering our 9th annual lecture on U.S.-Turkish relations in honor of Turgut Özal, a Turkish statesman, and enlightening us and educating us with his wisdom and expansive experience. And look forward to seeing you at the 10th lecture. And please join me in giving Matt a round of applause for his great job. Thank you.